I'm all for pirates has opened doors for everything, you know. Most of the Radio 1 specialists have all come from pirate one way or another, you know what I mean? It's like a stepping stone.
Radio programs don't need expensive studios and a big transmitter and a huge aerial. You can basically do it yourself.
It's a war out there, even getting on tower blocks. You've got certain caretakers getting involved and ripping your aerials down. It's going mad, and I do believe soon it's just going to crash.
The Last Caller Ring Back with Timmy Magic on 97 to 99 FM, Radio 1. It's sincere.
We're driving around Leighton in East London, listening to the pirate stations as you do. And we're just approaching the same tower block in the estate where we used to transmit many, many years ago. In fact, there used to be up to four pirate radio stations in one tower block at one time. But one thing I can remember about pirate radio, our station manager, he always used to say, never come into the tower block with your record box. Be discreet, or the DTI is going to get you. So what you had to do, you had to park about half a mile away and put all your records into a black plastic bag or a bin liner or something. Then you used to go into the tower block and you could be faced with a fellow DJ. What do you do? Do you smile, tell him where you're going, or do you pretend like neither of you are going to pirate radio, you're going around your friend's house, but you're both carrying plastic bags? Next thing is getting to your floor. The person in the lift says, what floor do you want? So you know you're going to number 15, but you play smart. 19, please. So what you do is you go to the 19th floor and you walk down. Some stations weren't as discreet. You could go onto their floor and hear the sounds just pumping out, and you think, God, blimey, there's an all-night party going on. But nope. It was the discreet sounds of a pirate radio. You then go to the door, knock on it, and you probably see the curtains just move ever so slightly, discreetly, just to make sure they knew who was coming in.
Let him in.
Then the door would open and they'd let you in.
Ah, come in, sir. Thank you for coming. Come in.
But the next thing is to sit down, set your tunes up, and ready to go out on air.
Is that a timetable? Well, get on it. It's your time.
For many, though, the 60s was the original era of renegade radio pirates. With the BBC finding it difficult to reflect the growing rock and pop scene, broadcasters took to the high seas, thus coining the term pirates, to provide the UK with its musical diet. Radio 1 DJ John Peel remembers.
I did actually work for about 5 months on the pirate radio ship Radio London, anchored off Felixstowe. And you got paid, I remember, through something like the Cayman Islands or somewhere like that, some kind of tax haven, and it all seemed slightly dodgy. And the radio station was run, as far as I remember, by kind of multimillionaires in Midland, Texas. But nevertheless, I was desperate for work, and also it gave me an opportunity to get onto the radio in this country, which is what I really wanted to do.
All right, now, for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action, here's a hit with them in mind.
I would come on at different times of the day and just play what was ever on the charts and the records that I was required to play. I was allowed to have a hit pick, which was picked for me by somebody in the office, and often turned out to be a record that I'd never heard in my life before, but it would go out as John Peel's hit pick for whatever the week was. Recreationally, there wasn't a great deal to offer, I have to say, and there were a couple of the engineers and myself who used to climb to the very highest deck on the ship, which was called something like the poop deck, I shouldn't be surprised, and sit up there and smoke dope and giggle.
What's so funny?
That was pretty nice. I rather enjoyed that, but found it was not a good idea to do radio programs after you'd been doing that, because there'd be an awful lot of records ending, then it kind of... That's just beautiful, you know. It's just the doors, man. Anyway, that was about the only recreation open to us, apart from playing cards and watching porn.
By 1967, the government had outlawed the offshore pirates and, supposedly coincidentally, the BBC introduced Radio 1. This was the end of DJs in boats in the UK. Pirates continued, though, with stations like Radio Jackie and Kaleidoscope flying the flag. It wasn't until the 1980s that the modern phenomenon of inner-city pirates was truly in evidence, as Richard Barbrook from the Hypermedia Research Centre at the University of Westminster explains.
The reason why pirate radio became possible in the 80s is that you could build transmitters for less than the cost of an advert on Capital Radio. And so effectively they were disposable. If you could do a gig or have an event or get a little bit of advertising, you could cover the cost of your transmitters. And particularly using some sophisticated linking technology, you could have a studio in one place and your transmitter in another. And it was actually quite difficult to find the studio. So this meant that when the Home Office investigators came to take your transmitter away, they wouldn't take away your record collection, which was probably much more valuable, well, inevitably more valuable than the transmitter.
Trevor Nelson.
In the early 80s, pirate radio for my music emerged via stations like JFM, TKO, Solar, LWR, of course Kiss FM.
Reggae DJ Nick Manessa.
I was aware of the first wave of pirate radio when I was quite a lot younger, which was stations like LWR and one which Gordon Mack, the guy who went on to found Kiss, was part of called JFM. It was really those two that were the first two big ones that I was aware of. I think Tim Westwood used to do a show on LWR, I seem to remember, and people like CJ Carlos, and that was very soul orientated. There was a little bit of reggae, but it was basically a soul thing, sort of back in the days when there was soul and reggae, and that was it.
What, yeah. The new soul and reggae pirates like Solar, JFM, LWR and the Dread Broadcasting Corporation paved the way for perhaps the most successful pirate of them all, Kiss FM. Kiss's founder, Gordon Mack.
We started because stations like JFM and Solar and some of these people that have been around for years, they all went off back in 85, and it meant that the airwaves were pretty clean. There was still, you know, there's a few stations still on. There was LWR and there was Fame and a couple others. There's two commercial stations and the BBC, so you had type of probably about 6 hours of dance music on legal radio a week, maybe type of 8 hours at a push. The first broadcast of Kiss FM was way back in 85. We broadcast from a squat in Charlton. I went on and done the first show. I can't remember what the record was now. I think it might have been Roberto Gilliam, All About My Baby, or something like that. We were coming on then 7 days a week. It is difficult to keep on 7 days in those days because there's a whole lot of pirates have gone off. The radio investigation squad came out and sort of just obliterated us over that Christmas. And we type of licked our wounds and come back on in the January or February because we was hit every day. I mean, it was just like, pyong, pyong, they're up again, let's get them, pyong.
Trevor Nelson. Everybody involved knew it was illegal. That was the lure as well, because I mean, when you're doing illegal house parties, illegal warehouse parties, I mean, doing illegal radio was just part of that whole scene. It made it more exciting. We knew it was illegal. I mean, we got scared when the DTI started threatening.
Now just behave yourself and nobody will get hurt.
You know, to do certain things if you got caught, like confiscate your records, slap you with a big fine. I mean, it scared the hell out of all of us, to be honest. But I mean, I would turn up for my show in the middle of Camden Market, you know, and then people were going, all right, Trev, you know, how you doing, mate? Yeah, see you at the club tonight, and things like that. And they knew I was supposed to be on the radio in 5 minutes, so the studio had to be closed, you know. But we never had anyone ever, I mean, touch wood, we were just unbelievably well looked after by the public.
Okay, let's get down to it then. Stay tuned, boppers.
With such a high profile, it was inevitable that Kiss and other pirates would attract the attention of the Department of Trade and Industry, better known as the DTI. Barry Maxwell of the Radio Communications Agency.
The agency is comprised of radio engineers who are looking for radio signals that shouldn't be there, and our methods are to try and detect those signals.
You'd make a good cop.
It's fairly easy to find transmitters and antennas, and when our staff do that, then it's a matter of removing the source of interference.
Well, the law relating to pirate radio is really quite simple. You need a license to operate a broadcasting radio station in this country, and what pirates do is simply set up on any frequency without any sort of license whatsoever.
Behave yourselves. Keep clear of troublemakers.
If an operator goes to a Crown Court, then that can be an unlimited fine or 2 years imprisonment. Or in the Magistrates Court, which is more usually where they go to, it's 6 months imprisonment or a £5,000 fine.
You're good. You're awful good.
Pirates have responded to the pressure of the law by keeping their studio locations secret and their equipment as cheap as possible. What's the point in spending hundreds of pounds on a studio setup only to have it confiscated? Drum and bass pioneer, DJ Hype.
You'd get an empty flat, or at one point it was upstairs a pub. It's just like, basically, what do you need? A room with two decks, a mixer, a mic, a pager or a mobile phone, and that's it. And you've got a box in the studio and a box on an aerial on a roof somewhere. You know, like you've got your transmitter and your receiver. It's very simple. It's shanty town, but it's real.
Once this was a typical high-rise council flat in Hackney. Now it's a pirate's fortress protected by 3 tons of concrete. Barbed wire fortifications sit incongruously on the roof of the block, the radio flat just below. Extraordinarily, the fence isn't there to keep the police and illegal radio inspectors out. It's the way the pirates get in. They abseil in. Hanging perilously from a rope, the youngsters behind this craze swing their way into the top window.
Trevor Nelson.
Basically, it was quite simple. It's very crude. The station was once in my own flat, so I know exactly how it was set up. I mean, for example, when it was set up in my flat, it was like we'd have 2 Technics turntables, a mixer, like a normal DJ setup, a couple of tape decks, which we used to run adverts from. You know, we had the pause button on. We'd lift the pause button off and run an ad. It was very, really crude. Our jingles were played the same way. Press play, whack the fader up, and you'd have a jingle. And then we'd have an aerial on the roof. I was 19 floors up, so we had mad engineers who'd go up there and rig it up. But then we had what we called a microwave link, which was a key thing in Pirate Radio. You had to have a microwave link because it was your way of not being detected back to your studio. So basically, imagine you've got an aerial on my block of flats in Leytonstone, beaming over to Crystal Palace or somewhere like that. So when the DTI came to raid us, they'd go to Crystal Palace and we wouldn't be there, we'd be in Leytonstone. By the time they touched our aerial, we'd be off the air and we'd scarper.
The cops ain't likely to catch up with us, not tonight. So we can all be quiet and peaceable and have a few beers together and listen to the music.
Nick Manessa.
A lot of the same technology and people were involved as who are making preamps for sound systems and sort of underground electronics industry, making the equipment, the microwaves and stuff that you need for pirate radio stations. It's all kind of brandless boxes that shoot the signal all over the place. And it was always, you know, there was a couple of Technics and a sort of basic disco mixer and nothing to turn off the volume when you put the mic up or anything like that. It was pretty basic.
Listening to Last Caller Ring Back, the story of Pirate Radio with Timmy Magic on 97 to 99 FM Radio 1.
Of course, with up to 1,400 raids in a year from the DTI, there are bound to be casualties. Garage DJ, EZ.
There was a few instances where I helped out on the roof, which was like setting up the aerials and hook up a transmitter and that. And there was one case where I was putting the area up on this block. We heard some noises and I was thinking, who's that? Like, everyone was being quiet and there's like a little hole where you could like stand and like look down onto like the next level of the flats. So we saw some guys down there and they must have heard us.
You might as well come down, Jared. There's no one left but you.
They're shouting up and it goes, if you don't come down now, we're gonna like shut this door. And if they shut that door, that's it. You're staying up there for the rest of your life, you know what I mean? So everyone just like walked down with like heads down, like sort of thing.
Steve Lamack.
First question that anyone asked was, what happens if the DTI turn up and try and bust the station?
Hello, police headquarters, please.
And the advice we were given was, if you hear some commotion at the front door, get out via the kitchen, go out the back door, leap over the fence and leg it. But there was also the precaution which Q102 took, and I don't know if other pirates had similar schemes, but the guy whose house it was where Q102 broadcasted from owned 2 Rottweilers, and the 2 Rottweilers used to sleep by the front door. So presumably, while DJs were legging it out through the garden and over the fence, these pro-pirate Rottweilers would be savaging members of the DTI on the front doorstep. I think that was how it was supposed to work.
We lost hundreds of transmitters. We was actually on as a pipe for 3.5 years.
Gordon Mack.
In that 3.5 years, we'd have a couple of weeks or a couple of months of it going brilliantly. Then all of a sudden, every time we turned on, we'd put a rig up Thursday night. Friday, it'd be taken down. Put another one up on the Friday night. Saturday, it'd be taken down. Put another one up and on the Sunday. It's a nightmare.
Richard Barbrook.
The authorities obviously have always disliked pirate radio, even when it's been very commercial and quite conservative. And I think this is because it's not approved by the state. Even today, they still see radio as primarily a way of spreading political propaganda.
It began to interest me, vaguely.
The Radio Communications Agency's perception of the risks posed by pirates is a more practical one. Barry Maxwell.
The operators use very unsophisticated equipment. It tends to stray across other parts of the radio spectrum, and I'm talking about interference to emergency services. Their equipment is so unsophisticated that the agency has to act to protect other users of the spectrum.
Get the itch between his fingers.
I have here a traditional biscuit tin, and within this biscuit tin is a complete transmitter. I also have here a transmitter mounted on a flat plate, and the transmitter is cooled by having alongside it a saucepan. And the reason that the saucepan is there is because that is where the water is held, and the transmitter is cooled by the water in the saucepan.
By the late 80s, the music scene was changing rapidly. House music from the US of A began to filter into the UK. Denied a legitimate outlet, pirate radio stations sprung up to reflect this new sound. This meant more competition for airspace and an increasingly hostile broadcasting environment, as KISS DJ Nick Manassa recalls.
There was quite a lot of rivalry between the different stations, and it was very high pressure. There was a point about probably halfway through 1988 where we were getting aerials stolen by rival stations, and a lot of pressure from the DTI.
I'll be seeing you soon.
But I remember one time being offered money to actually sit all through the weekend next to the aerial. It's because they were sure that at that time it wasn't the DTI who was busting us, it was other stations. And he was a big geezer, so they said to him, will you hang out by the aerial for the whole weekend and stop it from getting nicked? You know.
You hear me, babies? Good. Real good.
By 1989, the rave scene was set to explode in the UK. Pirates, like the clubs and record shops, had their role to play in developing the underground scene. Richard Barbrook.
Most new types of sounds start in the underground. They always start with a small group of people who get a great new idea, and they have their own little clubs and often their own strange way of dressing and way of talking.
Listen to the bassline, top.
And part of what the radio is first to give a focus to those groups of people. I mean, the rave culture being the most obvious example, where that really was created through pirate radio and clubs and tunes all interacting with each other. Once that scene becomes big enough, often from the pirate radios, the way it achieves a mass audience.
KISS's aim now was to get a legitimate radio license and go legal, which they eventually achieved in 1990. Other radio stations rushed to fill the gap, with pirates like Sunrise, Centreforce, Rave, Dance and Fantasy leading the charge. DJ Hype.
Fantasy FM was a big pirate station in 1989. And I was doing like 4 shows a week at one point. I really enjoyed it. You know, it was one scene then. You know, dance music these days is fragmented into so many different, even every style, whether it be jungle, whether it be house, garage. It's just like one big cake being chopped up and chopped up and chopped up. But back then it was just one big cake, and I'm very proud to be part of that. It was wicked.
As with the jungle and garage scenes, pirates were the only outlet for developing the sound of the underground. This gave the pirates a lot of power in shaping the success of new tracks. DJ Hype.
I did a tune called The Exorcist, and I remember this showed me the power of pirate radio. Did the tune, went round all the record shops in the West End to promo it, and they were virtually not interested. 2 weeks later of playing it on the radio, it ended up being the biggest tune of that year, 1990. I think it was MRIB's biggest dance tune in London. You know what I mean? And it just made me two-finger salute.
This is still the case with pirates now. Garage DJs Ramsey and Finn.
My most memorable tunes that broke through pirate have got to be...
The Bucketheads.
Yeah. Which didn't get any radio support at all. In them days, that was quite a unique track. Gabriel, Roy Davis Jr. track. So I remember playing that on radio, then playing it in a club, and the dance was like, looking at me saying, what is this tune? They've all stopped dancing. But more radio became a big tune, like a Flowers track. It's a good example. That's been around for ages. We were playing it, but it wasn't really getting much response. But Pirates kept playing it, and then it got through to the commercial sector.
Other music too, denied an outlet on legitimate stations, found a home on pirate radio. The thriving indie scene in the late 80s meant a need for stations like Q102, where our very own Steve Lamacq learnt his trade.
There was plenty to play with the Manchester scene had happened. Then into the start of the 90s, there were various bands coming through, the likes of Blur and then the Manic Street Preachers and Teenage Fan Club. So there was a sort of demand for the music and nowhere else really to hear it at that time. I got involved with Q102 myself after somebody phoned the NME where I was working and said, you reckon you know everything about alternative music, but you don't even know that there's this indie pirate station operating. So I went down there on a Saturday and went into this terraced house, and the studio for Q102 was in the dining room of the house itself, and it had a very, very small mixing desk, two decks and a tape player, and that was it really.
Now, for that group out there that had such a hard time getting home, sorry about that. I guess the only thing we can do is play you a song.
With pirates championing the tunes, the rave scene grew in the UK, developing into hardcore and then jungle scene in the early to mid-90s. Stations like Pulse, Rush, Don, and most enduringly, Cool FM, playing the new sounds of jungle, rose to dominance. Drum and bass Don, DJ Ron.
Cool FM was definitely the premier jungle station at that time, and still is to present date, really. I started playing for Cool FM, and that was in about, I think it was like mid-92, something like that. At that time, it was coming out of sort of like hardcore into jungle at that time, you know? There were like stuff from X Project, which was like Rebel MC. That was like, he was really popular at that time. Also, Ibiza Records. It was like really early V stuff, you know, V recording stuff. I can feel sweet vibrations. We had like DJs, obviously myself, Rocky also was really popular at that time. You know, even DJ Trace used to play on there. Brian G as well used to be over there as well. On the MC front, you had people like Moose used to pop in from time to time, Navigator, and the Ragga Twins as well. You know, it was like quite a big family, you know, Cool FM family, that's what they used to call it. From about Thursday through to Sunday, you know, it used to be constant 24 hours a day, you know, like supporting the jungle vibe, you know.
Cool and other jungle pirates ran the show for a few years before the house and garage sounds, which had always stayed bubbling under, became ever more popular. Stations like Girls FM were representing the US side of the garage sound, then UK garage kicked in.
All right, all right, all right. All right.
DJ Spoonie.
Around the sort of 94, 95 time, what started happening then was there was UK garage producers that were specifically designing the music for the UK underground scene, the UK garage scene, as opposed to us just having music that we borrowed a bit from here and borrowed a bit from here.
Man, can't you see it's all ours? We take all his goods and go straight up north, leave the old jackass trap.
Now we was having our own producers making our own music for our own crowds. Tough Jam, Grant Nelson were the main two people around that time. Tough Jam had a record called The History of House, and it kind of name-checked all the great American DJs and producers. Grant Nelson had a few bits out on Nice and Right. I mean, Nice and Right were one of the main labels, so they all like definitely helped shape the sound of the UK garage scene.
Once again, pirates were the place to hear the new sounds of the street, with stations like Freak, Magic, Deja Vu and London Underground blitzing the airwaves. DJ Ramsey.
We helped form a station called London Underground. That's where I found Spoonie, Mikey B, Dream Team. I got all the guys on there. Daryl B, Hermit, me, myself, Fenn, Mr. Jones. There was quite a good few DJs that were big in the UK scene now.
You think I come like this, huh, baby?
You know, it's a commonly asked question, where did you guys meet? How did you meet? How did your dream team form? Well, we became acquainted whilst all DJing separately on London Underground. pirate station local to where we used to live. Everyone was a friend of a friend and a mate of a mate, and Ramsey and Fenn were on there, who went on to do Love Bug, Hermit, Daryl B. So they're all like great classic names from the UK underground scene. You know, the Dream Team was born out of that. Now it's an interesting time because you had a lot of people from, you know, different sort of walks of life with this one common love, and that was really interesting.
Like fellow Radio 1 DJs, Tim Westwood, Trevor Nelson, Steve Lamack, Judge Jules, Fabio and Groove Rider, Dave Pierce, Simon Mayo, maybe not. Myself, Mikey and Spoony got our first broadcasting experience on illegal stations. For many aspiring DJs, this is the primary motivating factor for running risks of broadcasting without a license. DJ Hype.
I'm a professional DJ now. You know, pirate radio, you know, you couldn't go from bedroom straight to a mainstream station or anything like that. Pirate was an apprenticeship.
Trevor Nelson.
I think the best thing that came out of my stint on pirate radio was just the experience you got broadcasting, because it was like being self-taught. No one ever taught me how to DJ on radio.
What? You're a disc jockey? What's that?
I learned how to probably communicate with the public a little bit better as I rehearsed myself on legal radio. But on pirate, you know, getting over that initial nervousness and the initial ability to talk just to a microphone in a room with no one else in there. Without pirate, I don't really think I would have ever had the encouragement or enthusiasm or even the balls to do what I do now.
What we actually are doing is showcasing a lot of the talent what's in the area.
Are you singing your song, you can have a drink?
There's loads of MCs, loads of DJs, up and coming all the time.
The song, then the drink.
There's loads of stations just turning up, and we're one of those stations, and we're trying to just sort of develop the area and develop the youth and give them something like a platform for which they can sort of throw themselves into the main scene and get commercial and do what they got to do, you know?
It keeps kids off the street. It gives the people in the ghetto a purpose, and probably sounds corny, but it's true. You know, the pirate is usually the heartbeat of the street. The kid in the average estate is listening to the pirates. You know, the wannabe DJ who's looking at someone like myself is using the pirate as a stepping stone.
We know it's legal and that, and, you know, we're prepared to take the risk, we're prepared to do a bit of bird or whatever, you know, but it's not going to happen like that anyway, and we're going to run the risk and showcase the boys out there and the boys and the girls out there and give them something back in the community and try and expose them and give them something worthwhile to hang on to, you know?
With the UK garage sound firmly established as the dance soundtrack, pirates seem to be more popular than ever. Ramsey and Fenn.
Point of pirate is, if you switch a pirate on, you know you're going to hear a certain style all the time. If you're into that style and you put that station on, you know it's going to be there. Fashion thing as well. Yeah. Listen to a pirate.
It is a bit of a fashion thing, yeah.
Always being like, feel that you're going to hear the hip tunes on a pirate first.
The commercial stations, they're told what music to play. Stations, pirate stations, they play what music they feel the audience wants to hear.
At the moment, it's like garage is running things, really. It's so popular now. The kids, and they just love it, can't get enough of it. And we get so many people on the street saying, oh, yeah, we like your show then, you know, and that was kicking it and da-da-da-da. We're trying to do something nice for the community there, and they're showing their respect, and they're giving us, you know, they're listening there, listening hard, they're ringing in and hard all the time.
What of the future? Richard Barbrook and Alex Briley of the internet radio station UK Rumble.
We set up just over 2 years ago, come up with this idea of trying to give up-and-coming DJs a chance, really. Had various guests on, ranging the whole different spectrum from Larry Heard right up to, I mean, DJ Spoonie was on. Tony Humphries, it's just a vibe of getting feedback from listeners, questions coming in straight away. Joey Negro, when he was on, playing some disco tracks and stuff, and this guy from Brazil come in, and he knew more about disco tunes than Joey Negro, which was like, wow.
But I think the next stage is obviously going to be the internet. I mean, I think that is going to be the real breakthrough. Most pirates, it's the difficulty is getting yourself on air, it's transmitting. Now we have a thing where almost anybody who's got a net connection can transmit.
We use real audio software for people to listen to, and you can download that free. And once you've got it and installed it on your machine, you can tune in. and we have got other features on the site, and we've got track listings, got our own chat room that bubbles around and not necessarily talking about music. I mean, they just come in and tell us what a bad day they've had and all the rest of it. We've had people in Brazil throw beach pies through their computers and stuff, which is like, wow, how can they do that? It's sort of mental, but they have, yeah.
Some people have used it not just for music stuff. So, for instance, during the demonstrations last year, the J18 demonstrations, people put on a internet radio feed about what was going on. Now, of course, once you have internet radio, everybody who can listen to radio is also a transmitter. The way the internet works is a two-way form of communication. Every time you look at a website, you're effectively sending a message out to be able to look at anything. It will take some time for people to realise what this means, but it means that everybody becomes a transmitter. Bertolt Brecht, actually, the famous German Marxist playwright, did a radio play in the early 30s, and they asked Bertolt, what did he think of radio as a phenomenon? He said, it'd be very wonderful if everybody had a transmitter as well as a receiver. And I think Brecht's vision is about to come true.
Remember boppers, be looking good, real good. Adios.